when you really say, we've thought about where we're heading and it looks like this, and then we've got this this model, this actual picture of, okay, here's how these different actors connect, here's their kind of motivations, here's the kind of resources they need to do that, then you can say, we're just going to make continuous shifts and learn the whole time.
Hello and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak performing innovators in the creative, social impact, and earth conservation spaces who are working to change the world. This episode is brought to you by Brain FM. Brain FM combines the best of music and neuroscience to help you relax, focus, meditate, and even sleep. I love it and have been using it to write, create, and do some of my deepest work. Because you're a listener of the show, you can get a free trial. Head over to brain.fm/innovativemindset to check it out. If you decide to subscribe, you can get 20% off with the coupon code innovativemindset, all one word. And now, let's get to the show. Hey there, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. My name is Isolde Trachtenberg. I'm your host. I'm thrilled you're here, and I'm super thrilled and honored to have the two people that are here as my guests. Let me tell you about them. Jenny Wild. First, Jenny has over 15 years of hands-on experience as a senior manager in humanitarian response, and she's an innovation expert. She supported innovative organizations and initiatives in countries as diverse as the USA, South Sudan, and Nepal. She's pioneered initiatives that break from conventional innovation models and that enable global scale, and you know how close that is to my heart. World change through innovation is one of the things that I love most. Here's my second guest for the day, Dan McClure. Dan specializes in complex systems innovation challenges and acts as a senior innovation strategist for commercial, nonprofit, and governmental organizations. He has decades of experience as a systems innovation strategist working with global firms in fields spanning international aid, environmental activism, government, finance, retail, media, education, energy, and health. Wow, this is amazing, because the reason they're both here at the same time is because they decided to join forces and bring their complementary skills and talents together. And I'm so honored to have you both on the show. Dan and Jenny, welcome.
So lovely to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure. I have so many questions. One of the things that I really, first of all, I wanted to get started with the notion of, you have complementary skills from different perspectives. How did you decide to come together to help companies and organizations solve their innovation challenges? What brought you together, and how do you make it work?
You know, it's actually an interesting story. As you said, Dan has been focused on how to support companies going through disruption or disrupted industries, or on the other side of that, to really lead their markets for decades. And on the other side, I was working, when I met Dan, in humanitarian emergencies. So very chaotic contexts, Haiti earthquake, you know, big conflicts across Somalia, Iraq, typhoons, etc. Both of us trying to work out how to shift impact significantly, or in the private sector, how to create great leaps forward in value. And we met at Berkeley at an innovation roundtable, and it just sounded like we were doing really similar things as far as practice. And as we sat down and kind of mapped out a big idea for the humanitarian sector of how we might kind of create some big impact there, we kind of looked at each other and over the, you know, coming weeks and months and years, discussed, okay, we are doing similar things. Actually, we're creating big change, big impact, big value in very complex or chaotic circumstances. And certainly since I've moved some of my work into the private sector and Dan has moved some of his work into the social sector, it's interesting how similar some of those challenges are, in that they're very complex and the world is just moving very fast.
It certainly is. And you know what's interesting to me about what you just said, this notion of disruption and how things move incredibly quickly, especially in companies and organizations that are going through a disruptive process. It seems to me that there are opportunities there when disruption is happening to sort of steer the ship in specific directions. I'm wondering, how do you work within that, both of you, and how do you take advantage of that? How do you take advantage of that disruption to, in some ways, right the ship so that the entire system will be impacted and change?
No, I think it's interesting because one of the debates Jenny and I often have is, do we frame our work as responding to a threat or creating an opportunity? And, you know, the periods of disruption are really ideal for both. So you will find that the status quo is unsuited to the future. And so if you don't make a big radical change, if you don't let go of the things that you were doing before, you're going to find that your ship is not going to make it through. But at the same time, there's this real opportunity to reinvent things. I think one of the things that is most fascinating to me is that if you look at where there are truly innovative, like approaches to new electrical systems, it's not in places like the United States or Europe, where there's lots of embedded electrical systems and, you know, grids and power plants, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It's in the places where electrical systems are being put in for the first time, and you get to really imagine that from the first get-go. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of this, how do you make the change, is you look at the possibility of saying, I'm going to let go of my past system, and I'm going to imagine an entirely new system. Mm-hmm. And that sounds really scary, mm-hmm. but it's really no more scary than the kinds of innovation we've done in the past. It's just a different set of skills. It's a set of skills that says, instead of trying to solve one small focused problem, we're going to look across and see a broader problem and really reimagine that system. And that's the key thing, really, is begin by seeing the bigger problem and then move to imagining a new system that lets go of the status quo.
That's fascinating. I love the notion of letting go of the status quo. And yet there, it seems to me that there are times when it's almost a leapfrog situation where the old system might have worked before in decades past, for example, but it won't work for the infrastructure that's there now. I have an example. I was in South Africa doing a workshop for NASA many years ago, and all of the people who were from the surrounding countries had cell phones. And somebody's phone rang during my presentation, and he started speaking on the phone. And after he got off the phone, I said, you know, would you mind turning your phone off? And he said, oh, no, someone might call me. I can't. And I said, okay, well, then the next time you get a call, can you go out side of the room? And he's like, oh, no, I don't want to miss what you're saying. And I was a little bit frustrated by that. But afterwards, talking to one of the organizers of the workshop, he said, you have to understand, these people have never had phone lines. It used to be that to get from one village to another to communicate, they had to go 30 miles or 50 miles. Now, the cell phones have made it so that they can just go anywhere. They can contact anyone from anywhere, and it was revolutionary for them, and they were never going to get landlines. So when we're talking about these systems-wide sort of innovations, how do you work within that infrastructure in places like South Africa or Namibia or other places that are developing nations to allow for the fact that some things that we did in developed countries, that they won't work in developing nations because things have changed so drastically?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm just going to add to that, that I think it's not just in developing countries. I think it's the rate of change here is significant. So, you know, this decade is being called the Roaring 2020s, and we're seeing globally energy tech, AI, blockchain, biotech, many other types of significant tech and change mature. And that's set to impact everybody globally in our everyday lives. Mm-hmm. You know, you're seeing global education set to quadruple by 2026. And as we know, when there are significant amounts of people globally who step up in their education, there are follow-on effects from that also in the US, in Kenya, wherever that might be. And, you know, there's many other things that are changing, like energy tech and AI working together, and biotech and blockchain. And, you know, you're starting to get robotics and IoT working together to both kind of see and then do things for us without humans needing to be involved, etc. So I think really that kind of pace of change allows this leapfrogging, because if you are on a path of incremental change, if you say, okay, I've got a product and all I need to do is make a slightly better iPhone, or all I need to do is make a slightly better watch, great. That definitely worked, you know, last century and continues to be an important part of everyone's business and lives. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, the iWatch came in, and that can now measure your pulse. And Tesla came into the market and said, we're going to change the way that people use energy. And, you know, different small, what feel like small changes are actually quite significant, you know, over that 10 years, and allow us to significantly change the way we deal with health, because suddenly we can see how we sleep and our heart rate and some of our emotional ups and downs from our watch. You know, we can now change the way we basically get energy through our roof and have kind of power on the side of our house and feedback in to the energy network. And so I think where there is less of these, where there is less of these kind of steps forward, so, you know, maybe in Kenya or where there's some broken systems in transportation or otherwise, I think you can get greater gains faster, because you can say, well, we're just going to create a completely new system. So, you know, involved in a project called Hello Tractor in South Sudan, and it's essentially an Uber for tractors. So where farmers could never have access to tractors before, certain farmers, they can now kind of rent a tractor for an hour, and that can significantly change the yield, which changes the markets, which changes the education of their children, which changes the malnutrition of their children, et cetera, et cetera. So significant leaps forward in their lives because of a single change in the way that they farm. But I think it goes back to what Dan said, which is really reimagining that future, and that's being done everywhere. So, you know, whether it's in South Sudan or the US, those companies, you know, for example, Elon Musk is reimagining, you know, 8 industries at the same time. Amazon steps into pharmacy, and it completely changes the way that that pharmacy is done. So it really can happen to any industry at any time, where a company or an innovator says, I'm going to do something completely different, and, you know, we're going to try this, and do you know what? It works.
You know, I think there's an interesting aspect to this, Isolde. It can seem like it's harder to do this in an environment where there's nothing already in place. Mm. And yet the idea sort of behind like doing systems change is there's an existing system, there's a future system, and what you have to do really is imagine that future system and then figure out how you get from the existing system to the future system. Ironically, if you're dealing in one of these environments where there isn't as much already in place, you may have a resource problem, you know, supporting the new innovations, et cetera, in a South Sudan or a Kenya, but you don't actually have as many things that you have to push out of the way from the status quo. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as Jenny was mentioning, you've got all of these opportunities for change that exist all over the world. And the real question is how to, for each one of those contexts, take best advantage of those big changes.
I'm taking that in for a second. I want to make sure that I parse it so that I can sound at least a little like I'm not floored by what you just said. Okay, so it sounds to me like you don't have to clear out the cobwebs in order to begin something that is going to be this great innovation. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. Is that what you're saying? That if there's nothing to get out of the way, it can actually be easier sometimes to bring these systems innovations?
Yeah, so that's certainly true if you have nothing in place already. Mm-hmm. But that is a little bit deceptive in that you also may not have, for example, all the financial institutions in place, mm-hmm. all the educational institutions in place, the business practices in place. Mm-hmm. So the thing about system innovation, when you're looking at sort of like these very disruptive ideas, is they need all their parts. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, you have an easier time of making the change because you're not having to tear down the electrical grid to put in the new solar-powered microgrids.
Right.
But at the other hand, you may have to be creating an underlying banking system. You may have to create an underlying system of, you know, markets, et cetera, to support all of these things. So it's as if with each system challenge you've got, you have to look at both where you want to go, but also where you're starting and what you need to either build out or need to move away in order to make that change to the new system.
That makes so much sense. And it's interesting. What came into my head as I was listening to you speak is I almost want to have a blueprint, like a concept drawing of what are all of the components that we might need in order to make this new system come online, if you will. I know I'm sounding techie, but I mean, in general, if you need, for example, some sort of an infrastructure, if you need access to tractors, if you need a banking system that isn't there, you can either create one or develop one or borrow one in order to have a foundation for the innovations that you want to bring into the space, whether it's a country or a village. And I'm wondering, there something that you said made me go, do you, I don't know if you know the work of Olafur Eliasson. He's a Scandinavian architect of all things, but he developed this this little light called Little Sun. It's solar powered, and every time you buy one gets sent to places in the developing world that don't have access to electricity. So when we get back to this notion of bringing light so that people who want to read, for example, after they're done with work for the day, they can do that. They can have light for reading, and that's very back to basics. So when we're talking about this wish list of innovation, do you have one? Do you have something like that where if you're coming into a company, you evaluate what they currently have and then go, okay, now here's what we would need to build in order to get you to where you want to go. How does that work?
Jen, do you want to make a first shot at that, or would you like me to jump in?
Yeah, I can take a first shot. So there's a couple of pieces there. I think a list is the wrong way to think about it.
Okay.
So I think what some consultants or some practice do is they go into businesses and they say, I have my list, you know, let me see your business models, let me see your innovation process, let me see, we'll need to do a sprint and then we'll think about, you know, investment or something like that, mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z. And I think working with systems is really about stepping back. You know, we talk about it like it's the Matrix. Many businesses are walking along. They see, you know, they're in the crowd. They see the red woman. Maybe the red woman's their strategy even, and they're focused on that red woman.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not seeing the crowd from above. They're not seeing all the kind of interconnections. Mm-hmm. And especially they're not stepping back and seeing, you know, all of the zeros and ones that are creating that scene. And so what I think it's important to do when you walk into an organization is say, let's step back and let's see what this organization is. Let's see, you know, what this organization wants to do. And let's see what the industry, what's happening in that industry. And another way to think about it is, you know, we talk about having an out of business experience. So stepping, you know, having senior leadership step out of their own mental models of what they need to do on a day-to-day basis and say, okay, you know, I'm looking above my business and I'm seeing all the ways everyone's interacting, our partners, our clients, you know, really the external world from my everyday. And that's in some ways the system. And I think doing that then allows you to say, you know, I may have been heading down this strategy for the last 5 years that may or may not be working or maybe slightly working, and saying, okay, what is the system that our business is in look like? What does our industry really look like? Where are the kind of pressure points, challenges? Where are some of those big opportunities? And where is what's being significantly shifted? You know, which Elon Musk is basically taking petrol stations away from us mm-hmm. and adding in charging stations over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by doing that, by understanding the broader system that a business is in, you can then come back and say, what do we need to do? And that often includes a few different things. That often includes leadership setting a bigger mission. And I think it's important, of course, when you're looking at a mission or a vision, that executive leadership need to be on board and need to understand what that means and drive that through the organization. And that kind of that bigger mission is really around kind of stepping back and seeing the greater picture. I think the second thing you need to do is make that real through strategy. So bring together the organization. You know, often this happens in parts of the organization. You have a digital transformation that focuses on tech, or you have a agile transformation that focuses on product, or you have, you know, these kind of transformations. But really what you're looking at is the whole business transforming, the whole business coming together around this bigger mission,
mm-hmm.
around these bigger opportunities. And saying, okay, how do we set that strategy? How do we structure that in a way where ideas can pour in across the whole organization, where you can have a way across an organization of getting bigger innovations recognized and prioritized? And it's not just senior leadership or tech or whoever it might be in the organization who has the loudest voice. And so setting up those kind of structural pieces within the organization, and then really updating the kind of innovation or product, depending on where this lives in your organization, roles, creating roles that can connect across the organization, that can see the bigger picture, that can not only kind of accept and bring in from the organization these greater opportunities, but see how they connect into all the different parts and all the different activities mm-hmm. that your organization and your partner organizations do. And this, for example, is something that Tim Cook has done really well. You know, Tim Cook has made his mark on Apple growth through ecosystems. So not just looking at internally how Apple can work as one and connect together, but how Apple can create huge global ecosystems that grow Apple's products and make them better. So, you know, really, really thinking about not just within your organization, but outside as well, and finding the right people, you know, finding the right people who can see that bigger picture, move through more gray areas, you know, do the things that we need to do in innovation, test, adapt, grow. So I think in kind of, if you didn't have a checklist, you might have kind of areas to focus on being leadership, setting that bigger mission based around a broader view of challenges and opportunities, putting in the structures to be able to get the bigger innovations recognized, prioritized, invested in, implemented across the organization, and then bringing that organization together with product or innovation or otherwise that really connect across the business, see that bigger picture, and can have the tools and practice to implement it.
You know, Isolde, I think there's a really interesting sort of dualism here. You know, what Jenny was talking about is this sort of big system change that occurs inside an organization in order for it to be able to do systems changes in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But to your point earlier, in some ways, you need to also be able to envision a whole system in the market of all the different things that you need to have in place. You know, what are all your partners? What are all the structural elements? And for both of these, having some kind of a visual diagram, a visual model of how all the pieces fit together is just really essential. So, you know, as Jenny mentioned, not having a list, but having a model that shows here are all the components, here's how they connect, and here's how they work together to produce an output. That system view can really help drive a lot of this complex change, you know, that has all these different elements to it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you, for saying what you said. It's interesting to me. I worked, as I said, at NASA for many years and in Earth system science. So looking at the Earth system is another, to me, is another way of looking at what you just were talking about, Dan, this notion of what are all of those interlocking pieces, because they all work either together or at least affect each other. And so there's a lot that what you both said that makes sense to me on that visceral level, everything from looking at how the atmosphere and the hydrosphere and the biosphere all work together, and also the individual drop of water, how do we follow it all the way through the entire system? So both of them can coexist. And yet in a company or an organization, I can't help thinking that we need leaders who are courageous enough and mature enough to see that this needs to happen in their companies or organizations, and they need to be able to embrace this notion of innovation. So I wonder, when you go into work with a company and organization, to take it back down to the individual level for a second, let me ask it a different way. Do you find that leaders are ready for it when you come to them, or do you find that they are wondering what to do and not sure, and then you need to coach them almost through that very courageous process of going, yeah, we might need to have this huge disruption in our business in order to come out the other side doing something that's really innovative and world-changing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about system change is that there's many different levels and layers to it. You know, when you go in and you meet a leader, you may find somebody who's really not yet convinced that their ship is about to run aground. And as a result, a lot of the initial effort is around, you know, getting them to understand the severity and the need for disruption and why incremental innovation won't be enough. you'll also find other innovators, other leaders who have realized that the ship is coming up on a shoal of rocks, but don't really know what that means from a where they need to go. So then you've got the challenge of showing how a future system might, you know, allow them to succeed in the marketplace. And I would say most leaders are then some challenged by how do I change my organization so that my organization is ready to do this kind of deep fundamental change. And this gets back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier of just, you need not only the leadership to be on board, not only the leadership to be courageous and supportive, but you need new kinds of roles. Like you need an innovator who's really good at cutting across the organization, a choreographer of new ideas, who can not work within the silos, but be able to bust across those silos and really knit together ideas and opportunities. And it's that kind of organizational change that is what enables the leader who's courageous and who has seen the big challenge to actually bring their leader, their ship into a new direction.
Sorry, I'm thinking, I'm processing. That it makes a lot of sense. And this notion of new roles, integrative roles, almost, people like you said who can see across instead of just in a vertical silo, as you put it. They can see across the different disciplines and areas of the company organization. And I guess what I wonder is what does that look like? What do you envision? That really
choreographer?
Yeah, the choreographer. What does their job, their mission look like? And how does it break from the practices that everyone's been taught for the last, 100 years through the industrial age?
Go for it, Dan.
Jenny's throwing it over to me because this is really my area of passion.
Oh, yay.
I think there have been many types of innovators that we've had over the last 70 years. And, you know, it's been really exciting for me to have had a career that spanned quite a number of years now, because I've seen how the roles of innovators have changed. So initially, innovators were inventors. They were Bell Labs, and we've created, you know, a transistor, or we've taken and, you know, we've got a new glue that allows post-it notes. And so the inventor in the R&D lab was the innovator. At the turn of the century, this last century, there was the opportunity to see, oh, we've got, you know, new markets that are actually customer facing. And so the user-centered designer, the lean product designer became the new form of innovator. And these were folks that were much more engaged with the world around them, learned how to focus their attention on a specific problem for a specific user, rapidly developed prototypes, and that was very exciting. Today, the type of challenge that the innovator needs to address is how do they make multiple parts of an organization or a market all change together? And this is really less about raw creativity, like what you saw with the innovator, the inventor, less about going out and interrogating specific users, like you might have with user-centered design, and more about seeing the big picture of how all the pieces can fit together. Mm-hmm. And then acting as this, you know, we've used the phrase choreographer, but it really is a role about seeing horizontally across an entire challenge, seeing the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think about like what traits make a choreographer successful, it's they naturally see the big picture. So they start from the top down, looking for how all the pieces fit together. They're generalists. So instead of being apologetic about the fact that they don't specialize in a field, they embrace the ability to see many different things. They also tend to be sort of rebels within an organization, disregarding rules and structure because they're cutting across so many things. And so you take these big picture generalist rebels and they become the key enablers of this cross-cutting system innovation.
Ah, I love that you praise generalists. Yay! I'm a generalist. So for a long time, there has been sort of a stigma about being a generalist because being the specialist, being Steve Jobs was much more preferable to being someone who's good at a number of different things and can see things differently. And yet it feels to me like what you just said is embrace this notion of being a generalist, but it's also expecting or encouraging people, like you said, to embrace the fact that they may not have that one thing that they're great at. And genius often is celebrated because they're great at the one thing. So what is the cultural shift? And to me, this notion of innovation, the way you're talking about it, is a culture of innovation in a company and organization. So what is the cultural shift do you think that needs to happen in order to celebrate the generalist?
I'm going to do a quick bit and then I'll throw it back to Jen. I think there's two aspects of this. One, you need to actually embrace the type of people who are these generalist cross cutters. It's not unusual to go into an organization and find out that they've been systematically purged from the ranks of the organization. Because a cross-cutting rebel generalist who works from a big picture is not well aligned with an organization that features top-down control focused on specific well-defined problems.
For sure.
And as a result, choreographers often find that they're unwelcome, fired, penalized, et cetera, within an organization. So first off, you have to not chase them out. But then more ideally, you actually provide the structure and support to make it possible for them to succeed. And I think that's a bigger job for most organizations than they realize, because there's a whole bunch of institutions and practices that organizations put in place to make sure that the things that choreographers do aren't done. You know, you don't normally, if you're having a status quo organization, want disruption, cross-cutting, rebel, generalists rambling about your place. But that's exactly what you need if you need to do disruption.
And maybe I'd add to that, Dan, I think the cultural shift is also interesting to see from a historical perspective. So the 20th century, we saw the kind of factory production mechanism and project management really create, you know, great value and big positive change in the world. And I think in some ways we're still, some of us, many of us, are still stuck in that kind of mindset, that Ford factory. Where we don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world that is far more interconnected, with far more complexity, far more change, and bigger opportunities because of that. And so when you look at the kind of focus on project management, which is really great for kind of low complexity, stable projects, and will always be used in certain areas across organization. There's a real focus on efficiency, which is really useful. But where you have more change, where you have higher complexity in all industries today, you move to a focus on outcomes. And you see that shift in language, certainly in business. So we've got to focus on outcomes. You know, it's not about how long you've taken or how many people you've used or the throughput of your kind of tech work, but it's about you know, the kind of NPS score for X, or it's about growth in this area for a Y, or it's about, you know, pleasing customers in this area. I think many organizations talk about outcomes, but they implement through efficiency metrics. Hmm. And so I think that's one of the big cultural changes, because when you shift to outcomes, you actually move to more of a gray area. You move to less command and control. You move to a more an area of organization where you can iterate and adapt and grow faster. But it is more uncomfortable for some people, because they don't see those efficiency numbers that they thought might be heading them in the right direction, but perhaps certainly weren't. So when you start to focus on these outcomes, I think many pieces unroll. And one of those is, if you're looking at outcomes, you need to have people who can see the outcome, who can work towards that. And that is almost always a generalist. The second piece around this is that generalists, choreographers can look very different. So, you know, Dan and I talk about there's visionaries. So, you know, the kind of Elon Musks, but all the way down the chain, mm-hmm. who can really kind of envision that future. There are those kind of action heroes who go in and they take charge and they lead and they work out, you know, how to get from A to B where it's not clear and they're focused on outcomes.
And by the way,
there's a kind of,
I'm the visionary, Jenny's the action hero. When we go out for beers together, this is how this works.
I love it.
But there's also, you know, fixers, you know, the people who fill the gaps and get ideas unstuck. And I think there's all kinds of people who can be incredibly helpful. It's not just like there's one type of person who can see the future.
Sure.
And sometimes organizations might look to hire, you know, a mini Elon Musk. They say, oh, we need someone who can think about the big picture and imagine the future. And they might need that, but they might need someone else. They might need a range of people to really create change in their organization, not just one disruptive person who can be really helpful, but may need the support around them to make that happen. So I guess I want to kind of pull out that idea of generalists and say there are many of us and there are many ways we can be helpful.
Oh, I love that you said that, Jenny. Thank you so much. And it's interesting. I developed this little matrix that's generalist versus specialist and visionary versus implementer. And the combination of those different things are a lot of the things that you're talking about, which I love. And I love that you talked about sort of the transformation to looking at outcomes rather than efficiency. I would love to ask you something. This is very close to my heart because I worked at NASA for many years. What about when you don't, when you have an idea of the outcome, but you can't actually even begin to see it? And the way I'm thinking about it is climate change. That takes a long-term view, if you will, because weather is today, right? It rained today, but it didn't rain yesterday. Climate is something that's hard for people to conceptualize. And so when you have people who are trying to disrupt and innovate in climate change space or environmental space, what are your thoughts? What's different about that kind of global change that you might not even be able to envision the potential outcome? You just know you need to work on it.
So actually, we are working on that. So that's, yay, some of the things that we're working on in this sort of system space are, what do you do to really make an impact on climate? Mm-hmm. What do you do to help reduce the impact of future pandemics? So these big, complicated problems, you know, are really ideally suited for a systems-based approach. And I think we almost directly challenge the idea that you want to go and figure out a bunch of things to do. there's obviously lots of things we could do right now. You know, we could shut down a coal mine, or we could improve the, you know, efficiency of batteries, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of activities you could do. But for this to actually be a sustainable change, what you have to do is end up at a system that works in the future that produces the effects you want. And so when we work in these fields, we start by saying, here's all the systems that exist today. You know, here are the cars, here are the roads, here's the gas infrastructure that provides fuel, et cetera, et cetera. But then the next step is not to start saying, where are all the changes, but rather, what's the end state that you want to end up with? What does that future system look like? And how do all the pieces fit together there? Once you've got that, then you can say, well, I'm here today. I want to end up over here. What are the things that I'm going to do to make that possible? And of course, you don't have a crystal ball that lets you know exactly how that future state's going to go. But you can put together the big model of how the future is going to look in your current view, and then adjust that as you move forward. But having the big model, that gives you an ability to focus your actions in a way that just sort of the random whack-a-mole approach to big complex problems almost never does.
I can absolutely see that. And it's interesting, this notion of conceptualizing where you want to see the future to be 50 years, 100 years from now, and then working towards it. You end up with a few left turns where you meant to go right, depending on factors you can't possibly know 20 years from now. So when that happens, when you have to make those changes, what does it take? Does it take leadership to be able to do that? Does it take the choreographer to be able to see that this is what's happening and now we're going to have to hang a left at Albuquerque? Like what needs to happen in that almost ephemeral plan in order for that still to be the end goal, what we said would happen in 50 years?
I'm going to use this example from NASA because most people know it and, you know, you've worked there before. But in continuing on this idea about outcomes, if you're looking at outcomes, if you say, you know what, we've gotten together and we have looked at what we're trying to do. We're trying to put a man on the moon. And you can ask your organization, you can ask the plenary says, yeah, I'm working to put a man on the moon. When you've got that agreed focus on outcome, it's so powerful because then it's not about, oh, well, I need to go to leadership to ask for this small change. And every time I do that, there's just a bunch of wasted time and work and just difficulty and I look bad, et cetera. When you really say, we've thought about where we're heading and it looks like this, and then we've got this model, this actual picture of, okay, here's how these different actors connect, here's their kind of motivations, here's the kind of resources that they need to do that, et cetera. Then you can say, we're just going to make continuous shifts and learn the whole time. So when you put down what the world looks like now, you're starting system, starting model. You're not going to get that perfectly right. When you put down what you want to happen in the future, of course, you're not going to get that perfectly right either. It's an acceptance that we all, don't know everything and live in, you know, complex, changing times. We live in a global world. And so you can say, you know, I tested this slight shift in changing government priorities at X, you know, meeting, and we've tested this slight shift in transportation models in the US, and we're testing this slight shift in changing buying behaviors of customers for, you know, I don't moving to paper bags from plastic bags, or we've tested this slight shift in business behaviors moving to carbon credit schemes, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can test multiple things at the same time and say, so here's how they reacted. Here's the kind of shifts there. And so we see we might slightly shift where we're going to go in the future. Or actually, we've learned a little bit more about where we are now. We're going to slightly shift that. So the idea of what does the system look like now and what does the system look like in the future, what you want it to look like, they shift and they grow and they get clearer. And it gets really exciting because as you move along that path, you get a clearer, very practical, and it stops becoming a vision. It starts to become a reality of how you're actually changing the future, how you're shifting incentives and motivations and government policy to support this better version of the world, this better version of the future. So, you know, while sometimes this can sound very big and visionary, actually working on it feels incredibly practical. And it's just kind of these constant slight shifts and learning that goes into it. And if you focus on outcomes, then you can do that.
No, I think one of the things that it's exciting about this, and you know, this is where embracing complexity actually is much more concrete than it might seem, is this focus on we know what the future needs to look like and we've got alignment and around the outcomes we want to go towards allows every level of the organization to make adjustment, not just the senior strategist, which is often what happens when you've got like top-down control over strategy. So somebody who's working on a particular piece of technology can make adjustments because they see how what they're doing is needs to adjust to be able to move towards the future vision. Somebody who is the choreographer working across the entire organization can be working to help align people around a new vision. Or a senior executive can be making changes at their level. So these agile organizations are not just simply nimble. They're continually looking out, learning, and adapting at all parts of the organization. And that's what makes it possible to do this complex stuff. It's because you're not trying to have one person plan the whole thing. Rather, you've got an entire organization that's helping flex their systems towards the new system view that you want.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Both of you, thank you so much for explaining it so beautifully. It reminds me of, this is where I first read it, in Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference, on negotiation. He talks about something called commander's intent, which he defines as a sort of a crisp, plain talk statement that specifies a plan's goal or a desired end of state of some sort of an operation. And so, Jenny, when you mentioned going to the moon, when President Kennedy announced that this was the goal, within 10 years they'd put a man on the moon, there were a lot of reasons he was doing that. There were a lot of political reasons and all of that. But the commander's intent there was very clear. We're going to do what we have to do to win the arms race and all this other stuff. But the plain talk statement was, we're going to put a man on the moon within the next 10 years. And so then everybody had a very, in many ways, simple premise and idea and vision or outcome, as you say, to get behind, to align themselves behind. And yet now we're living in a world where people are doing very strange things. You know, I believe what I read on the internet, and therefore I'm not going to put a mask on or whatever. However you view wearing masks, there's the science, and then there are people who are believing YouTube influencers who may or may not have science behind them. And there's a lot of discontent and disagreement on climate change is, you know, one of my pet subjects. So what do you do when you have people in an organization that they've gotten this crisp and clean commander's intent, we're going to work on climate change, we know what the outcome is that we want to have, and there's somebody who goes, well, you're totally wrong, this will never work. How do you prescribe to handle those kinds of situations where you can have such huge disagreement on something that might have a lot of scientific support or other support?
You know, I think oftentimes the problem is not the person who says, oh, we're not going to reinvent the organization this way. That, you know, I really disagree with the fundamental strategy. The bigger challenge is often the person who says, yeah, I get that. And then on a day-to-day basis is making decisions consistent with a different way of working. And, you know, there's the phrase, the frozen middle, because often middle management is charged with avoiding change, documenting risk, making sure that all decisions are based deeply in evidence and, you know, have been thoroughly thought through. And so in good conscience, based on all of their best practices for years and years and years, they push back on the kinds of things that enable agile response to system challenges. And, you know, I think it's less about the sort of deniers of a strategy and more about the people who cling to an organizational practice that doesn't allow for system change. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, who do you want to engage with in an organization? There's going to be clearly those people that, you know, are ready and anxious and have been just waiting for something like this to happen. Then there are going to be the skeptics that you need to bring along and explain and show that it actually works. And then, honestly, in some cases, there are going to be folks that aren't going to come along for the ride. And, you know, that's in some ways a sad thing. But in other ways, if you're not in a position to really contribute to the way an organization is going to be working in the future, it's not fair to you or the organization, you know, to, you know, keep this sort of misfit in place between you and the organization.
And I think adding to Dan what you said, but moving that up a level to leadership, I think what you sometimes have is you have a leadership or a CEO saying, it's up to me, I have to find the solution, I have to work this out, you know, incredible amounts of anxiety and pressure and stress in this kind of project management control lead model, efficiency model. And when you actually step back and talk to leaders and say, do you have to, is it really up to you? Do you have to find the whole solution in this, you know, in the, for example, pharmacy industry that is changing and many people are going to kind of shift roles, leave, there'll be new, there are new actors all around the place. Do you, is it really up to you? Do you have, can one person really do this? Of course they can't. Of course one person doesn't have the answer alone. You know, if you're going to see the bigger picture, that takes an entire organization to work together and to have, you know, positive conflict and change opinions, etc. And so I think part of that is kind of swapping what you said on its head, and rather than saying dealing with the people who say, well, I don't want to be part of this, dealing with the kind of backsliding of behavior that there has to be a command and control and one person has to come up with a solution and have the kind of stress and anxiety and moving to a place where you can say, well, logically, it shouldn't be up to one person to focus on what this whole complex space looked like. It has to be up to a group working together. It has to be, you know, a systems model that you put together and you agree on and you understand and move together. So I think some of these kind of mindset shifts at the leadership level are more, you know, it's almost easier when someone says, well, I don't want to get on board. It's harder when someone, when leadership say, I'm on board, I agree, this is great, but I have to make all the decisions here and I have to find the solution and it's up to me.
Yeah.
And that's just not, it's not logical in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but there's one thing just as a quick note here, because oftentimes, you know, particularly this is true in the social and aid sector, there's been a realization that, you know, you need to have many voices in order to form a good view of things. And so as sort of a half step towards this broader organizational inclusion of all the voices in meaningful ways and systems change, you get a half step that's just, I'm going to have participation. So I'm going to get input from a lot of people, but I'm still actually going to centralize the decision in one place. And what we're advocating for really in a systems environment is not the idea that it's about participation and getting lots of voices and then a single decider. It's that lots of information, there may be somebody who synthesizes all the information, but the entire organization is actually responding and adapting to it. And that's a very different thing than simply, you know, making sure that I listen to lots of folks while I make all the decisions myself.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I as you were talking, both of you, I was thinking of moving, deciding to walk. Can you imagine if your brain decides to walk and tries to send that message to your legs and your legs go, nope, not doing it. And that's it, right? So the whole body has to work together. The whole organism has to work together in order to accomplish that task of I'm going to go get myself a cup of tea. It takes a complex set of instructions from the brain, from the leader, but every part of the organism has to participate or it just won't happen. So your points are incredibly well taken. And I will be honest, I could keep you here for the next 6 hours and ask you more questions, but I know you have lives to get back to. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this in such an interesting way. The way that you're talking about it with the notion of systems change and looking at outcomes is, as I said earlier, close to my heart. So I'm thrilled that you're doing this work, and I'm particularly thrilled that you are doing so much work on climate change and other humanitarian and environmental issues and causes. I'm super grateful that those causes have you in their corner. I want to thank you so much for being here. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind, because people learn differently, I like to both put the links in the show notes, but also ask you to say where people, somebody's here listening to this and they go, wow, I want to work with these folks. I want to know more about them. How could somebody find you and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, great. And it's been lovely being on your show too, by the way. Really enjoyable conversation.
Oh, thank you.
So they can find us on Twitter at INNO_ecosystem. INNO_ecosystem. You can find us on the website, innovationecosystem.com. You can find us on LinkedIn. We're actually writing a book currently on the kind of thinking and practice of this. So, you know, feel free to sign up on our website and we'll let you know when that's coming out. But yeah, it would be great to hear about what others think and join the conversation.
Oh, that's wonderful. And they're doing construction next door. I don't know if you can hear it. I will have to figure out how to edit that, the sound of the drill out. it happens. Brooklyn, we live very close together, right? So, yes. And when you're ready to have the book out, if you'll let me know, I will edit the show notes to include the information on that, because I know that this is a book that I'm going to want to read for sure. And also getting that information in the show notes so that someone who's listening wants to grab that book for themselves, they'll be able to have an easy link to it. Thank you so much for all of that. Do you know what the book's going to be called yet? Have you decided?
Many working titles, including Do Bigger Things.
That's great. Very, I like that. That's a great commander's intent. Do bigger things. Just plain talk. I love
go
that.
Go to the moon.
No, but Siri, I mean, it's really wonderful to me when I get to talk to people who obviously know their stuff, but also who aligns so beautifully with so many of my passions and interests. When you start talking about NASA and going to the moon and climate change and humanitarian causes, my ears perk up. So I'm super grateful that you both took the time. I have just one more question for each of you. I ask this, it's a silly question, but I find that it yields some profound answers. And the question is this, and Jenny, if you'd go first, and Dan, if you'd go second, I'd appreciate it. The question is this: if you had an airplane that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
Gosh, it's a very good question, isn't it? Well, I'd spend weeks constructing a message first. Do you know what? I would probably do something incredibly. It would either be something like do bigger things, like get out there. You can do this. This is not about these kind of, you know, big idols who can create great change. It's about everybody and imagining the future. But in the end, my heart really goes to kind of inequality and vulnerability and making this a fair and safe place to live. So it would actually probably be something incredibly cheesy like you matter and we care. Well, something like that. I can't help it because that's where my heart goes.
No.
But I'd probably craft that to make it slightly less cheesy.
No, I love cheesy. Cheesy is my thing. I love cheesy. When someone asks me, well, Zolda, what would you say? I said, be bold, be creative, be kind. That was it. And if it's cheesy, I stand with the cheese, I have to say. So, you know, I fall on the side of cheesy and I'm proud of it. So, yes. No, Jenny, thank you. That was great. Dan, what would you say?
So the tattoo that I'm considering getting is Daniel Burnham's Dream No Small Dreams. Because they have no power to inspire men's action. But that actually sounds pretty painful at the length of that. So I think if I was skywriting and paying per the letter, I might go with embrace your complexity. Because I think if we learn to embrace the complexity of the problems and the opportunities that matter to us, that's the path to being able to do something that will really matter in the world.
I love that. Yeah. And it's you know, this is a call to action that I think is both important and daunting. Embrace your complexity, because it is. It takes a vulnerability, I think, like you said earlier, Jenny, to be able to embrace that notion of, yeah, I'm complex, and also, Jenny, to tie you yours in, I matter. Both of those being there together, I can see why you two make such a great team. I'm, again, super grateful that you took the time to be here. Jennifer Wild and Dan McClure, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been great fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Isolde Trachtenberg for the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I know you enjoyed this conversation because you love innovation as much as I do. If you did and you want to know more about Dan and Jenny's work, head over to innovationecosystem.com. Find out about the incredible work that they're doing, helping make those kinds of systems changes to make innovation go now and into the future. If you like the show, do me a favor, rate and review it, and or tell a friend. In fact, do both. I think that would be awesome. Until next time, this is Isolde Trachtenberg reminding you to listen, learn, laugh, and love a whole lot. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new, and it would mean the world to me if you told a friend about it. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2021. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, remember to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind.